Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. America is in crisis, says our distinguished guest, America's 39th president, Jimmy Carter. Since leaving public office, one of the few things President Carter has not done is engage directly in America's political scene. He's confident the American people make good decisions if we have good information, and that's the problem. President Carter says that Americans have been misled, that critical information has been withheld from us. So he's come forward to voice his alarm, to tell us what has really been going on right in front of us. While President Carter's written many admired books, he says one, Our Endangered Values, America's Moral Crisis, was different.
I approached this book with a great deal of hesitation. As a former president, to express my views this blatantly and unreservedly was something that I had not done before. And I was very careful. A number of commentators have pointed this out, that I never made any personal criticisms of President George W. Bush. You know, I think to some degree he's responsible for some of these policies, but that's something to be debated and resolved in the political arena.
The political arena is familiar territory for former President Carter. He was elected to local office in his hometown of Plains, to the Georgia legislature, then to the governor's office, and from 1977 to 81 served as President of the United States. He also had a distinguished career in the U.S. Navy. A graduate of the Naval Academy, he was an officer on the first experimental nuclear submarine. And after Dwight Eisenhower, had more military experience than any president since those who served in the Civil War. A lifelong farmer, craftsman, and prolific writer, President Carter expresses his personal and religious values in many ways, especially through the Carter Center, the non-governmental organization which he and Mrs. Carter founded. He was given the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts in pursuit of peace, democracy, and justice. Bill Russell and I share President Carter's deep concern about the dangers of America's current course. When President Carter accepted our invitation to join us in this uninterrupted one-hour conversation, we were pleased to accept his invitation to join him in his private conference room at the Carter Center in Atlanta. President Jimmy Carter, some years back, as we were beginning this program, I heard myself regularly saying we live in a time of great change. And after some years of hearing myself say that, a woman who I respect very deeply said, yes, that's true, and you might also think that we are living in a time of great choice, that really might describe our time better. And as I was reading Our Endangered Values, I kept thinking about that we have choices, but we have to know what they are, and we have to make those choices. As you were working your way through a dozen different issues about our current time and place, were you thinking about these choices? Did that shape in your head that there are choices to be made and maybe we just don't know enough about what those choices are?
Well, as deeply concerned as I have been about recent massive changes, seminal changes, dramatic changes in our nation's policies, I've also had the reassuring feeling that in America, when we are uninformed people, in this heterogeneous society, that we have a self-corrective factor, and that in the past when we've had crises like the McCarthy era, the American people show their sound judgment in the long term. But when they are misled or when they are confused or when the information on which they make judgments is not available to them, then for transient periods they can be incorrect in their final judgments. When they get the information they deserve and need in a free society, they make the right choices.
You refer to the American people as being trusting in part of Our Endangered Values. You speak about the Iraqi War and that many people, trusting citizens, as you call us,
yes,
were willing to be supportive. And yet the trust has to be based on fact and truth, doesn't it?
Yes, and I think many members of the House and Senate who voted in favor of giving the administration the right to go to war if necessary felt, first of all, that it would be necessary before that action was taken, and secondly, the evidence presented to them in securing that approval from the Congress proved to be erroneous, whether it was deliberately distorted or just serious mistakes, still is a fact that has not yet been ascertained and which may still be in the process of concealment.
Reading this book, I will say I was, a little bit, it was a little bit depressing because you lay out a list of conditions that are substantive conditions that affect our way of life. I found myself thinking about moral hazard. I grew up at a time when we believed that America had achieved perfection in democracy, that we'd sort of ended history because we had achieved this state of more or less perfection with respect to democracy. And my sense is we got lazy about it. Is that a fair description?
I think we got lazy and a little self-satisfied, a little proud of our tremendous military and political and economic and cultural influence around the world.
And we have lots of things for which to be proud.
Of course, this is a great, powerful, influential, an admirable nation. What has concerned me, and the reason I wrote this book, it's my 20th book, but it's the first one I've had a chance to express strong political views, is that the changes that have taken place in Washington in the last 5.5 years have been dramatic and unprecedented changes. It's not a distinction between Democrats and Republicans or between conservatives and liberals. It's a departure from all previous administrations. It's a radical change, a number of them, from what George Bush Sr. did, or what Dwight Eisenhower did, or Gerald Ford did, or even Ronald Reagan did, along with, obviously, all the previous Democratic presidents. So these changes have been seminal in value. They involve basic things. They involve peace. They involve human rights. They involve justice and fair treatment of people within our own country. They involve our national and international reputation. And they're all deleterious, in my effect. They've all been retrogressive. But many of them have been justified by the erroneous or false allegations that our country was under imminent attack, that we were threatened by weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that Saddam Hussein had been the perpetrator of the 9/11 attacks on our trade centers.
Which were just demonstrably not true.
Demonstrably not true. And I think that some people, at least in administration, certainly the knowledgeable people within the intelligence community, knew that they were not true and told some of the top people in the nation's government the truth. I think that truth was probably concealed from the president.
You talked early on about how tempting it is as president to take decisive unilateral action rather than going through the agony and the challenge of negotiating with people. And I read that, and then I went back and read it, and I said, decisive action. We tend to assume that decisive action leads to decisive results. And it seems to me that that's part of the confusion, that acting boldly and bravely and forcefully does not necessarily guarantee that the reasons you do that will, in fact, come to fruition. And it seems that's part of what's gotten us into this mess.
Well, if you combine decisive action with a fundamentalist attitude that I am right, everyone else is wrong, it obviates the possibility of compromise or accommodation of changes based on facts. It also involves exclusivity and unilateral action based on false premises, even though the action is decisive, is almost inevitably destined for failure. I think that President George Bush Sr. took decisive action in the first Gulf War, which I, by the way, opposed. But at least he consulted with many other nations. He didn't move until he had almost a unified international community behind him. And, of course, he made his decisive decisions of a very limited nature, that is to force Iraq to abandon its goal of taking over Kuwait. So there are differences in decisive action. Decisive action is not always successful if it is not based on correct premises sound judgment and cooperation with others who are necessary to make the success possible.
Well, and you referred to fundamentalism, talking about that, and that is a theme through this book.
Before we go there, I just want to make clear, I always have to go into my own brain and say, multilateral, unilateral, multilateral, unilateral. Unilateral means you act alone.
Absolutely.
It is uni as in one. And the difference, as you talk, I do want to specifically go to the fundamentalism, but it's part of this overall thinking that a unilateral, I'm going to do it alone, versus a cooperative also has something to do with this fundamentalism approach to life.
It does. A fundamentalist, by definition, believes that he or she is uniquely related to God, and that my premises as a fundamentalist are those of God. And therefore, anyone who disagrees with me is inherently wrong. And the next step is inferior. And the ultimate step for some societies is subhuman. That is, their lives are not significant in the eyes of God. So there are three characteristics of fundamentalism. One is superiority. I am superior to all others. The second one is non-compromise. And the third one is exclusivity. I don't need others. And so this is painted not only international affairs, which we've discussed briefly, but our domestic affairs. The Congress now is in an unprecedented state of being divided along black and white lines. There is no nuance. There's no forum within the Congress for actual debates and discussions on major issues. The decisions are made within political party forums. The Republicans dominate. And unless you agree 100% with the leadership's position in those forums, then you are punished as a Republican. You are endangered with losing your seniority or with losing your chairmanship of a committee or membership on choice committees. So the decisions are made quite often without any debate at all. Debate is inimical to a fundamentalist concept of what's right.
And is at the heart of a democracy.
That's exactly right. And I think this strikes at the heart of a democracy. That's why I said our endangered values, America's moral crisis. It's not only on international affairs, torturing prisoners or spying on Americans or declaring war or setting policies of preemptive war rather than our ancient commitment by all presidents that we don't go to war unless our own security is directly threatened. Those kind of changes have been radical in nature and a deep concern to me and others.
You distinguish between the individual and the society, and you do it, you know, based on your faith in terms of agape, which is to a lot of people, I think, probably wouldn't mean anything, and simple justice. The one being an individual characteristic, the other being what you say is, you know, really quoting
Reinhold
Niebuhr. Yeah.
Well, Niebuhr wrote a book about this. And that made a big impression on me when I was first, even before I ran for public office. Niebuhr said, in effect, that the highest goal for society was justice. And that's very, very important. Fair treatment for everyone and equitable access to the law, things of that kind. And it's very important. Agape love, though, is the highest goal of a human being. And that's love for someone who's not lovable. It's love without expecting recompense or payment. Sometimes it's love in secret where you don't get credit for being nice and kind. That's not the role of a society. That's not the role of a president. A president can't practice in international affairs or domestic affairs agape love. You have to be sure that justice is reached, but not self-sacrificial treatment of others if the sacrifice is made by your own nation, whom you have chosen to lead.
And to protect.
And to protect.
It's interesting to me to hear your assertion of these things, humble assertion, in the context of your own lifelong faith. Now, I am, as are you, a great proponent of the strict separation of church and state. And both have their places. This goes back to Jesus, that I mean, whether you're in the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament, there are places that this is very, very clear. Yes. And I found it intriguing that as an individual citizen, and then reflecting on your time as president, that they are separate, and they are also important each to the other. But this whole business of the merging, the murkiness, as you talk about fundamentalism, this very clear constitutional requirement of us all has been defied.
Yes. Well, it's, in many ways, it's not murky anymore. There's always been down through the ages some, you know, inherent interrelationship between a person's faith and public duty in office. So that's not what's at stake. But I think that the prohibition against the mixing of church and state is expressed not only by Jesus Christ himself, who said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's, but Thomas Jefferson, who publicly said, I'm speaking for all the founding fathers, in effect, said we should build a wall between the church and the state. The First Amendment is not quite that extensive. It's clear enough. But in the last two decades, a little bit more, there has been an ostentatious merger of the right wing or conservative or fundamentalist religious leaders on the one hand and the right wing or conservative elements of the Republican Party. And it hasn't been a secret. I mean, it's been public and with a lot of bragging on both sides, not concealed at all. And that is unprecedented in our country.
We talked recently with Bruce Feiler, you may know from Walking the Bible and Where God Was Born and other books, and he, on this subject, pointed out in his reading that when religion and politics gets too close together, inevitably it's religion that is damaged over the long run rather than politics, that these strictures are not just a matter of protecting the political structure from religion, but it's also, importantly, protecting religion from politics.
And his example was Iran.
Yes, that's true. And Iraq earlier and so forth. There's no doubt about that. In Saudi Arabia and other countries where there's one dominant religion, where dissent is restrained or prohibited, and anybody who disagrees with a certain group of human beings' interpretation of the scripture is a violation of the law. And that's one of the aspects of fundamentalism that applies in religion and not in politics. The religious fundamentalist is always male-dominated. And one of the first aspects of that is the subjugation or subservience or inferiority or exclusion of women. And that's a major premise that applies in religious fundamentalists that not always apply in politics. But there's no doubt in my mind that the Muslim faith, the Jewish faith, the Protestant faith around the world is suffering now from this rigidity of definitions and the exclusive nature of a few powerful people who control a particular aspect of religion, derogating those who disagree with them. Well, when this becomes the prevailing premise of the political system, then that punishment or exclusivity or domination of a few permeates the entire society and not just within a religious denomination.
Well, and as Bill was saying, this business of it being the religion that can suffer. There are a number of people who have argued that, yeah, it's not good for politics, but look at the religion itself, that it becomes corrupted by being powerful. And it go back to any of our Judeo-Christian, Greek, African. We know what power does, and it's not about religion.
Well, this goes back to your articulation. That's why I found it so striking, your articulation of agape. Agape and power are, at least the way, you know, in the constrained, our constrained understanding of what power is, those are not the same.
No, they're not. In fact, if you equate agape love with that demonstrated by Christ, his emphasis was on humility. and servanthood. He never mentioned domination or power or prestige
or rulers.
Rulers. Or rulers. He didn't mention rulers.
You also, I feel like I'm in Sunday school here, you also have, you. If you think about what are the three temptations that Jesus faces in the wilderness?
Yes.
Teacher.
That's right. Well, obviously, it's a power or authority, not over other people in the political realm, but also power over the natural forces of nature.
And he declined that. It was a temptation, and he declined.
Exactly. That. In fact, that was the first thing he did after he was baptized, as you know, by John the Baptist, was to go into the wilderness and to face the tempter. And Christ set an example, and he told his disciples who were struggling with one another to be the right hand, at the right hand of Christ when he came into his so-called power. They were envisioning political power. He said that the greatest among you is the least, the servant of all. But in some elements of our religious society now, there is an anointment of certain political leaders with authority over others.
And that is in inappropriate melding, it sounds.
In my opinion, it is.
I find it interesting to be talking about religion, again, saying that religion and politics have to be separate, and yet it's important to talk about religion because there are many religious people in this country, and there are many people who are not, and both should have a voice. And some of what I'm hearing you say, in one of the dangers, one of the endangered values, is that the willingness to hear other perspectives demonstrably is going away, whether you're looking at the Patriot Act or you're looking at just what happens in the public forum. And that is a devastating loss to a people governing themselves, isn't it?
Yes. There's never been any prohibition against an individual person trying to exemplify religious faith in public service, justice, kindness, humility, service, peace. We worship the Prince of Peace, not preemptive war, by the way. But there also is a need for that religious person in public power, particularly in a country like ours, not to show any ostentatious preference for one particular religious faith over others. A devout Catholic like John Kennedy, or a devout Protestant like I was, like the president is, should forego any opportunities to exalt one's own religion to the detriment of other religions, or to the detriment of those who profess to have no religion, and the exact equal treatment of all citizens in America, with public funds and with public statements and endorsements and accolades, should not show a preference for any particular religion.
It also seems to me directly in this track that that's what the law is about, that everybody gets treated equally, that the law is the law. We decide. We, the people, decide.
This is the simple justice of which you speak.
Exactly. And simple justice is very complex and very important, and quite often is endangered.
And much of what I was reading as you talk about endangered values could be fixed if we respected the law and if it did apply to all equally. I mean, whether you're talking about the Guantanamo devastating embarrassment, I haven't big enough words for how terrible it is that America is now seen as a torturer. If the law were to apply, that we would already be down the road to being back to the kind of America I think you espoused.
Well, there's obviously a need to comply with domestic law and also international laws, which we have sometimes written ourselves, sponsored ourselves, endorsed and incorporated into our own legal system with the full stature of a Constitution. After the Second World War, with the Holocaust, and with obvious suffering of people who were taken as captives, including, I mentioned in the book, my own uncle, who was tortured for 4 years by the Japanese. He was found finally at the end of the war, barely alive, weighing only 85 pounds with terrible varicose veins and so forth. But as a result of that, the Geneva Accords were established, which set a standard for the treatment of all prisoners of war. And now we have foregone the application of the Geneva Accords after 9/11 and have now revealed secretly tortured people, not only in Guantanamo, but also in Abu Ghraib. And also, it's been revealed by our own military that 28 prisoners have died through homicide. So far as I know, nobody's been punished yet, because the administration still claims that we are impervious to the restrictions against torture.
It's almost as if we can decide what laws we're going to obey now.
That's exactly the way it has been done. And we've always had a prohibition against the NSA, National Security Administration, and others, spying on Americans. And now we find that this basic law has been abrogated, that no warrants have been obtained, and that literally thousands of Americans have been spied upon by our own government.
You don't say much about it in this book, Our Endangered Values, but it's sort of an underlying predicate. You and the Carter Center over the years have been deeply involved in voting.
Yes.
In voting rights, in helping people who haven't had those rights to exercise those rights, and helping societies that have not been democratic or imperfect democracies improve their democracies. You and the former Secretary of State, James Baker, worked diligently to put together a system for this country that would bring more people into the political process, into the voting process. And it seems that as much as anything, I read this book and I think, so what are we going to do? How do we fix this? How do we overcome these challenges? And it seems that part of it is an educational challenge. Part of it is an institutional challenge, a legal challenge. Part of it is a process challenge. We have to get people, allow people, help people exercise their sovereign will with respect to our government.
Well, after the 2000 election debacle, President Gerald Ford and I performed this service. And we made a number of recommendations, I think about 50. And they were surprisingly incorporated into a major bill passed by Congress called Help America Vote Act, HABA, HABA. And they are now being implemented to some degree. The problem in our country, maybe it's not a problem, it's an asset, is that each state is basically autonomous or sovereign in handling up election procedures. After the 2004 election, it became obvious that there were still some serious problems not corrected. So James Baker and I, former Secretary of State, did a similar service, and we've made our recommendations public now. The Carter Center has helped with elections all over the world. In fact, we've completed our 61st election, which was in Liberia. A woman was elected president in Africa for the first time. And our 62nd election will be just a few days after this interview. Our third experience among the Palestinians as they choose the members of their own Palestinian Authority Parliament. So we are familiar with election laws around the world, and I think that within our country there has been an excessive degree of diversity in the election procedures, no uniformity at all, and always the poorest people, the most ignorant people, the most weak people politically are the ones that are deprived of their basic rights. This was proven in 2000 in Florida and still is proven. So we're trying to make that uniform. And the other thing is that the conservative leaders of our country are very determined to minimize the number of new voters who might be inclined to oppose them if they go to the polls. So the Republican-dominated legislature, for instance, in Georgia, has done everything it could to preclude the easy registration of African-Americans or Hispanics or others who might vote, or older people who might vote democratically. And so these distorted approaches to full participation by citizens in the electoral process are of great concern.
That's about as fundamental as you can get with a democracy.
Well, it is. It is. And both Gerald Ford and Jim Baker and I, both very good and prominent and influential Republicans, and I have tried to do what we could to make sure that these defects in our American voting system are corrected.
Going back to something you said early on about how we got into this mess and about the American people, What I heard you say is that given the information about what's going on around them, that the people, by and large, Americans tend to behave fairly well, which sounds like we're not getting the information, that there is a failure somewhere in the system of presumably the media to get out an unbiased representation of what's going on in the world, and particularly those things that matter most in a democracy.
Well, after I wrote Our Endangered Values, I had to go to press in July of 2005 to get the book printed. There have been a number of revelations to the public of what is actually going on that have been enlightening. And I think that the recent public opinion polls and the recent corrective action that has been initiated within the Congress is encouraging, which proves, I think, the fact, to repeat myself, that there is a self-corrective element within the American public, if we are well informed. When I wrote the book, I didn't know, and no one knew, I presume except a few people at the New York Times who held up a story, that the administration was spying on Americans, contrary to the law. I think it's unconstitutional, as a matter of fact. And we didn't know earlier on about the horrible torture being perpetrated in prison. We didn't know about the ostentatious bribery of many members of Congress through large contributions through lobbyists. These kind of things are now being revealed. And I think as they become known, the public opinion polls show that the American people are becoming increasingly disillusioned with what's going on.
You spoke of the McCarthy era. I grew up in the McCarthy era. I remember it. It is personal to me. People talk about, weren't the 50s great? And I say, where were you? Haynes Johnson makes a very strong case that we are not dealing with something that is new so much as something that has gotten strengthened over the last 50 years. He talks about a direct link between McCarthyism and terrorism. And sometimes I think it's good to know that things really do have a history. You don't have to be a history buff to know that it matters. That we do need, when we get this fixed, these dozen different things that could make you crazy, we still have to pay attention. That these strains are old and long and strong, and that had we been paying attention, we perhaps could have avoided some of these extreme deviations from what is genuinely the American heritage.
Yes, well, I think vigilance is a word that I would use. I think the American public needs to be vigilant. And too much, I think, in the last, since 9/11, there has been a timidity within the American news media, a reticence to reveal information that they know. Because there has been a very successful policy in the higher levels of our government to brand anyone who disagrees with their misguided policies as unpatriotic or a fringe element. And I think only recently have the public news media become brave enough or courageous enough to say, these are the facts as we know them, and let's reveal them. But there was a time that there was quite extensive time, 2 or 3 years almost, when it was not considered appropriate for the New York Times even, or the Washington Post, or CNN, to reveal something that may be banded as not supporting our young men and women who are overseas fighting.
Telling us the truth is their job.
That's their job, unadorned.
Well, there is a definition that it is the role of the media to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And yes, it seems in this particular, what you're talking about, that they absolutely fail, that they absolutely reverse that.
There's no doubt about that. I think that's certainly true. And now there is a slow awakening. You know, the New York Times has still not revealed why they waited a year to reveal the secret spying, which is inherently illegal and unconstitutional, spying on American citizens. I don't know why they haven't revealed it, but the fact that they delayed it just proves what we've just discussed, that there was a reticence then to be critical of a commander-in-chief when we were ostensibly at war and our young people were dying overseas.
Well, and as you say with an underline, the only underline in our endangered values is the United States is not at war.
That's correct. It's not at war. This, uniquely, almost in the history of this country, this particular war and the suffering from it has been confined to a tiny percentage of American citizens. That is, the young men and women who have actually been sent, now for the third time, some of them, to Iraq and their immediate families. Everybody else has been completely excluded from any sort of sacrifice, even increased taxes. In fact, the richest and most powerful people have been given enormous tax breaks at the expense of the working class Americans and certainly poorer Americans. So no one has suffered. I certainly have not suffered because of the Iraqi war. And I would guess you, if you search through the entire administration leadership, even search through every member of the House and Senate, you would not find a single family that has a young man and woman in Iraq. These are a different kind of people, and they're the ones that signed up for the National Guard and the Army Reserve, and they are the ones that are sent back over and over. We have a maid who's a member of our family almost, Mary Prince. Her son is just finishing his third term in Iraq, and many of his fellow soldiers, he's in the 48th Division, have died over there. But nobody else in Plains has been touched by the war at all.
It seems part of the challenge with this public information, the media role, that there's another piece of this, and it goes to the scandal you referred to, the role of money in politics, the role of money in policy making, more pointedly. Yes. And we seem to have gotten ourselves into, and the president has said, current president has said, we're at permanent war. Well, there is a constituency for whom that works very well. The defense industry likes that. The security industry likes that. And and we've done the same thing with respect to drugs. We've done the same thing with respect to prisons. And it seems to me, in addition to this challenge of public information, that part of what makes the public information harder to get at is so much of where that information comes from is also controlled by economics. And somehow or other, it seems we have to find a way, and this is a question, how do we do that, to get money out of politics, or at least minimize, put it under the same controls that other things are subject to.
Well, just in the last few days, there have been some, I think, probably superficial efforts within the Republican leadership in the House of Representatives to correct the Abramoff scandal causes. And I don't think it's going to amount to hardly anything to say that lobbyists can't buy you a meal, or even that lobbyists can't take you to Scotland to play golf. That's very superficial. What has happened mostly is the earmarked funds that are placed now, I understand 15,000 of them in the most recent major appropriations bill. In the middle of the night, by one particular member of the House or Senate, without his fellow members even knowing about this allocation of funds, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars, in secret. And the rest of the members of the House and Senate are required to vote on that bill without even ever having a chance to read it. This involves hundreds of millions of dollars, whereas buying somebody some meals at Abramoff's restaurant is a tiny little thing.
And it does not address what your predecessor, Dwight David Eisenhower, called the military-industrial complex.
That's correct.
It simply doesn't.
No. And that's a dominant factor. And the major oil companies, Halliburton and others, the major polluters of our environment, the major miners who don't even comply with safety precautions, as well as the military and others, are subverting the political system, and it's become acceptable and even quasi-legal to do so.
The issues you raise in our endangered values, I'm trying to go through it with this other filter. I mean, fundamentalism is an underlying theme in that, but it seems like this economic challenge is also an underlying theme. If you look at each of these issues, even the fundamentalist piece, it seems that the economic drivers, I can't remember who said it, but basically somebody said years ago that any business wants to be a monopoly, they will do whatever they can.
Sure.
And it is part of the role of the state, of governments, is to prevent that because it's bad for the people. And we have it seems, turned off most of the checks and balances that prevent that kind of dominance of economic power in this country.
Well, one aspect of it, it was in the news recently, is the miners' deaths in West Virginia. When I was in office, we passed some very strict mining safety regulations. Over the intense opposition of the mining industry. And they've been in effect until the last few years. And now it's been revealed that this particular mine had more than 200 findings of dangerous procedures. The average fine was something like $65. That endangered a person's life, and it turned out that the total number of fines levied by the mine's safety supervisors in Washington, that only about 20% of those fines had ever been paid. So it's an obvious coalition of the major industries and the government that subverted the safety of these miners. This is just one very small example of a permeating problem.
This goes to something that, in a way, you're almost uniquely qualified to talk about. We talked with Dennis Hayes years ago. Dennis Hayes,
he worked for you during your administration.
He was all set to not make us energy independent, but to make us less dependent, to develop alternatives, and this goes back a ways. And the administration changed, and all of a sudden he was on the street, and we're still fighting those energy challenges. But I say that in this context because for all the headline issues are important, particularly with this administration, the replacement of personnel, the people that have been driven out of government in the regulatory and the policy making and the enforcement throughout the government, 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 layers down in the government, even if we had a change of administration, it seems that the damage that has been done, the mining safety is one example of that, but the government is full of that. And these are the things that really affect how you and I live, at least I live.
Sure. Well, with the intense lobbying effort and the influence on Congress and with the natural affiliation of leaders in our executive government with major industry. And some of it's family. There's an inevitability there that when there are vacancies either created normally or through discharging watchdogs, that this has shown up in all aspects of environmental quality. It's shown up in the efficiency or lack of efficiency in automobiles. It's shown up in mining, as we've just described, and in almost every other major industry.
Well, as you say, just that environmental piece, the energy piece, had the regulations that you had put in place, you and your government had put in place, and the Congress,
administration.
Had we continued with the fuel economy standards,
sure.
We would be in much, 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 much better shape. We wouldn't even have to talk about Alaska, though we would. The parochial interest in right now, as opposed to some sense of looking forward, looking, what's going to happen in 10 years, what's going to happen to our children and our grandchildren and our country, our matrimony or whatever. that short-sightedness seems to be very dangerous.
Yes. There's some other aspects of this as well. For instance, we talked about radical departures from previous policies. Ever since the time of President Dwight Eisenhower, 50 years ago now, every president has struggled to improve the control of nuclear weaponry and to reduce the danger of the proliferation of nuclear explosives. And we made some progress. Collectively, what I did, what Gerald Ford did, what Eisenhower did, what Ronald Reagan did, and what George Bush did all the way back. All of that has been subverted, either canceled or publicly disavowed or secretly changed by this administration in order to reduce or eliminate any restraints on the right of our powerful nation to test nuclear explosives, to develop new nuclear explosives, and not to be bound by any restraints on either nuclear weapons or weapons in space. And not only the development of them, but the use of them. All of us in the past have said that we would not use our own nuclear weapons against a nation that didn't have nuclear weapons. This administration has disavowed that policy. So if you look at every single major nuclear weapons control agreement that has been negotiated for the last 50 years, they have all been set aside and no longer are applicable. And countries like North Korea and Iran and others, along with Pakistan and India, look on our example and say, if the United States won't restrain itself, what kind of power or authority should they have morally or economically to restrain us? It lowers a barrier for nuclear proliferation.
We were right here doing a program a year ago with Jane Goodall and Jonathan Granoff on this very subject. And New Zealand, one of the middle states, yes. New Zealand's Minister for Nuclear Disarmament, they right. have one. And it brings us back to the Carter Center and the fact that the rest of the world really should have a voice in the world's future. And there's nothing more, well, you say that the great divide between rich and poor is that which we look forward to into the future, which is the great subject. And nuclear proliferation is that which could keep that future from happening.
That's true. At the Carter Center, every 5 years, we have a meeting of the middle states. And the middle states, as some of you listeners may not know, these are states like New Zealand and like Argentina, like Brazil and others, that have the capability of developing nuclear weapons, technologically, educationally, and so forth, but have chosen not to do so. And they are the kind of the balancing force. And their voices here, when they meet here, is one of almost unanimous condemnation of the United States for not setting a good example in restraining ourselves and restraining our allies.
Well, there are two really striking quotes in our endangered values. One is from John Bolton, who now nominally represents me at the United Nations, saying, "I don't do carrots." Well, that kind of an attitude in the world, I mean, you wouldn't want a parent like that, but apparently there are parents like that. Hmm. The nuclear nonproliferation and all of the subjects around nuclear everything, what America does has not only a great impact at home and in the world, our reputation is being phenomenally eroded. I mean, some days, it pains me. Some days, it's hard to be an American.
Well, we have programs in more than 65 nations in the world. Rosa and I travel a lot, 35 nations in Africa. And it is very disturbing to see the reputation that our country has lost. I spent a lot of my time when I was president trying to bring peace to the Middle East and had a treaty between Israel and Egypt evolved, which is still intact. But our two most fervent and loyal supporters then in the Arab world were Egypt and Jordan. And I noticed a recent Zogby poll that showed that in Egypt only 2% of the people look with favor on our American government. In Jordan, only 4%. So that means that 98% or 96% of those former allies of ours look with disfavor now on our country.
Well, and for people who don't pay attention, Egypt really still is the leader amongst the Arab states.
It's the most powerful, most influential.
And the most populous Arab nation.
Obviously.
And to have that kind of decline is dangerous. And this notion of not looking ahead, looking at our feet, skiing, looking at our feet, which is a real bad idea. The nuclear proliferation in the context of terrorism, you know, to me, looking two or three steps ahead seems to be probably the single greatest threat to American well-being imaginable.
That security.
If you've got every more or less Tom, Dick, and or Harry out developing nuclear weapons, some of it's going to get loose.
Yes.
And some of it's going to end up in New York or Atlanta or San Francisco or Des Moines. And the more of that that is out there, the more dangerous it is.
And as you say, violence begets violence. You say that in two or three different contexts, and that's nowhere more important than thinking about what is our genuine security.
One of the problems with nuclear proliferation, strangely enough, relates directly back to the definition of fundamentalism. It's inherently impossible for a fundamentalist to mediate or to negotiate or to compromise or to communicate with some entity with whom they disagree. And so we have abandoned the previous policies, for instance, of the Clinton administration. I was involved, too, of at least having conversations directly with the North Koreans. And I think that under President Clinton's administration, I was involved, there was a very good arrangement made with the North Koreans. When the new administration came into power, they announced, we are not going to have any direct communications whatsoever with North Korea. We have the same policy toward Iran. And instead of us negotiating and accommodating their legitimate requests or requirements, we draw a total barrier between us and won't even talk to them. And so all of the previous agreements that had been worked out with North Korea, for instance, have been completely rejected by this administration and therefore with North Korea. So there's no avenue through which we can moderate these radical and certainly unjustified moves by North Korea and Iran toward nuclear capabilities.
This seems to be, and listening to you say that, this seems to be a policy predicated on rhetorical excess. It sells well on talk radio. It's very simple. It's very macho. Easily repeated.
And not true.
And stunningly naive.
Yes, there's no doubt about that. And that's one of the advantages of a fundamentalist premise, because it is simple, cut and dry, no equivocation. No gray areas. It's black and white. I am absolutely right, and it's a very simple premise to put forward. And anyone who disagrees with it, not only is wrong, but there is an almost inevitable effort made by proponents of a position to derogate the character of the ones who disagree with you, to tear down the reputation. This happened to John McCain, for instance, in South Carolina, during the 2000 election.
And if one does that in one's own in the privacy of one's closet, as St. Paul says, fine. The problem becomes when you do that out of the White House, isn't it?
Yes, or in a political campaign. And now that has exacerbated an already bad adoption of negative advertising. And the uncontrollable amount of money involved means that you can buy these 30-second spots and make an effort, often successful, to completely destroy the character of your opponent.
We only have 3 or 4 minutes left. Go ahead, Bill.
It seems that we as individuals, as a society, as a body politic, are the victims, the acolytes, the product of our stories, the stories we tell one another. And one of the charming things, for all it's a little depressing about your book, is that you are telling these stories in the face of a huge contra story that is being told by and large by the public media, by talk radio, that has dominated the American discussion for a long time. And it seems that part of the challenge for those of us who are constructively intended is to begin to tell these stories, tell them publicly, and to do it forcefully when necessary. Isn't that part of what you've been doing?
Well, one encouraging fact is that I wrote this book, I was very careful about research and authenticity. There's not been a single allegation of an error in the things that I put forward in this book as evidence. But I think the overriding factor that should be remembered is that to be repetitive, is that within the American free political system, there is a strong capability of correcting our mistakes and eliminating extremism and bringing the virtues that have made America a great nation to the forefront and preserving them. So I don't feel that we're in any permanent danger of losing America's values. The other thing that we should remember is that although this is not a nation that's at war, that involves everybody, the young men and women and their families who actually are in Iraq repetitively at the danger of their lives and safety, they are to be especially honored as heroic and self-sacrificial. We owe them an extraordinary debt of gratitude and support. And I think those two factors ought to be remembered as we outline the problems that we have identified in our own present political system.
I have one 30-second remaining question. That is, how did you keep your temper while you wrote this book?
I didn't always keep my temper.
You had an editor.
I used to get furious, and I was... I approached this book with a great deal of hesitation, and because I didn't, you know, as a former president, to express my views this blatantly and unreservedly was something that I had not done before. And I was very careful in the book. A number of commentators have pointed this out, that I never made any personal criticisms of President George W. Bush. You know, I think to some degree he's responsible for some of these policies, but that's something to be debated and resolved in the political arena. And I think to a number of degrees, as I pointed out in the book, some of his subordinates that are in high levels had plans, determinations, to invade Iraq, for instance, long before 9/11, and they were able to realize their long pent-up ambitions to establish a major hegemonic center of American power and influence in the Gulf region long before George W. Bush was elected. So I don't, I want to be careful. I always have been careful not to make any personal criticisms of the president.
You have done us an immense favor to the nation, a service yet again. President Jimmy Carter, we are so pleased that you would join us. Thank you.
I've enjoyed it very much. Your questions and comments have been very helpful to me.
For more, visit the Carter Center's website, cartercenter.org, or our website, paulagordon.com. President Carter's genuine moral authority makes our endangered values compelling reading for everyone. We thank President Carter for his leadership. The kind of country we choose to be is up to us. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.